You hear that? That's the sound of Pepsi Zero Sugar, the better tasting, more refreshing Zero Sugar Cola. Listen to that endless pour. Pure refreshment. If it sounds this good, just imagine how it tastes. Oh yeah, so good. Pepsi Zero Sugar. Let your taste decide.
At Care Heating and Cooling, we put you first. You are the reason we're open 7 days a week and why it's easy to schedule service at careheatingandcooling.com. Your safety is why we check every gas furnace for carbon monoxide. And it's because of you that our techs are paid to fix your furnace, not sell you a new one. So it's no surprise that last year Care was awarded a BBB Torch Award for ethics, because at Care, we're committed to doing business right. Call Care at 1-800-COOLING when you need a company you can trust.
Hi, I'm Mike Dilk, and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family, and your friends. Each week, I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. Great show this week. Start with a huge topic. I talked with Dr. Hilary Jones, who was at the opening of a new private hospital, about capacity of the NHS and ways that it can be managed.
They have the right to be removed from that waiting list and transferred to another hospital where the waiting list is shorter. And surely that's in everybody's interest, even if it's a private provider, knowing that the NHS isn't going to be out of pocket as a result.
Then the next topic is the humble egg.
So if we are worried about our cholesterol, you do not have to limit eggs at all. All the limits have been taken off, but you still need to be worried about those foods that are high in saturated fats.
Dietitian Dr. Carrie Ruxton puts us right on some of the myths regarding eggs. So please do join us for a great show. Thank you. So when I caught up with Dr. Hilary Jones, he was actually attending the opening of a new hospital, and I asked him if he was cutting a ribbon.
I am. Yes, I am. I'm going to say God bless this hospital and all who ail in her, because it's a really special day. The hospital has been refurbished completely. It's brand spanking new, and it's kind of almost unique in that it'll be offering care for both NHS patients and for private patients who choose to use the Wellsoon brand, which is part of it.
Where is it?
So it's in Edgbaston, in Somerset Road in Edgbaston. Okay. And it's the 12th hospital of this group, which is called the Practice Plus Group.
All right. So it's kind of essentially a new hospital. Is it one of the 40 new ones that the last government spoke about a lot and got into a lot of trouble for?
No, it's not. It's an independent hospital owned by this group that have 11 other hospitals around the country, and a wonderful reputation and pedigree and history. What's unique is that it has no legacy waiting lists at all currently. Now, we're in a region of the West Midlands here with people on a waiting list of about half a million people waiting for a hospital appointment on the NHS. And right now, this hospital will soon be able to take referrals from GPs or physios for NHS patients who want to use the choose and book method, whereby they can compare waiting lists of hospitals, they can choose their location and be referred here.
And I definitely want to ask you a little bit later more detail about this choose and book idea.
Yeah.
But yeah. Tell us about the hospital. You know, how big is it? How many beds are? What's the operating capacity? You know, how many knees can it fix a day?
Well, there are 29 beds in this hospital, and at full capacity, they'll be able to carry out about 8,000 procedures a year, which would make a huge dent in the waiting lists currently in this area.
It will make a dent. 29 beds. I thought you were going to say more than that. That doesn't sound very many to me.
No, it's a nice size. You know, I'm always in favour of smaller hospitals. They're better run, better managed. The staff will know each other. I like that. It for me, In my experience, over 40 years of general practice, it means formal personalised care. Huge hospitals are all very well, when you've got super specialities. But I think for run-of-the-mill procedures, the in-demand procedures like orthopaedics and endoscopies and cataracts, you want a medium-sized hospital because it's just a more personalised unit. It knows what it's doing from top to bottom. And you know, that would always be my preference of somewhere to refer patients to or somewhere to be referred as a patient myself.
So you're a doctor yourself, but managers might think, oh, I like economies of scale. Let's have hundreds of beds.
Well, I'm not a manager and never will be. they have their own particular skills, of course, without wishing to be rude.
Go on, be a bit rude. It's fine.
I couldn't possibly. Many of them marvellous. But no, of course, their priorities are different to mine as a clinician. My priority is always the patient. And having been a patient myself, I understand what patients need most. And what they need most is access to quick care, to efficient care, which is safe. They want good aftercare as well, sympathetic nursing, and they need to know what's going on. So if they're coming in, whether they're under the private umbrella or whether they're coming in as an NHS patient, that's what they're looking for. They all have that in common. But if you are a private patient, and of course, we know that more people are tempted to go privately, you want something where you know what the costs are going to be from the outset. So WellSoon, which is a sub-brand here at this hospital, will have fixed costs. You know what you're getting for the money that you pay. It's very affordable compared to other healthcare providers. And there are no spiraling costs, no hidden costs that comes a nasty shock at the end of the day.
So this new hospital with its 28 beds or whatever, is it going to specialise in any sort of area?
It's going to do most of its work in orthopaedics, in endoscopy and cataract, where there's most demand. So, for example, hip replacements, knee replacements, some shoulders, endoscopies, gastroscopies, colonoscopies. There's a huge waiting list for these procedures, which, you know, are necessary to get early diagnosis and better outcomes. Cataract surgery as well, where people are waiting, and all the time suffering from poor vision, unable to read, unable to recognize faces and things like that. So I know what it's like to have a hip replacement myself. And you know, if you're in a lot of pain, if you can't do the things you want to do, like go to the gym, go for a jog, take the dog for a walk, sleep properly. Being on a waiting list is miserable. So the quicker you get off that waiting list and get sorted, the downtime for hip surgery is short.
And actually, you can get back to work and pay some taxes, apart from anything else.
Well, absolutely. It's good for the economy as well. But you know, getting rid of the pain and getting more mobile, it's life-changing. And most of my patients who have hip replacements, I wish I'd done it sooner because I've got my life back.
Right. Were you in that category? Because you've had it done.
I have had it done. And my hip was worn out from playing a lot of sport over the years, which I don't regret because it was good for my heart and lungs. But one of my hips was quite painful, and it got urgently and acutely more painful to the extent that I was really, really suffering. So I got it done, and I spent a lot of time. It's very important for people to do their rehabilitation and their physio after surgery. You can't just rely on the surgery itself to put you right. You have to work at the rehab afterwards. It's equally important to the surgery. So I did mine, and within 6 weeks, I was doing all the things I used to do before my hip became painful and less mobile. And I would encourage people in that situation to get it done as soon as possible.
All right. You did mention a little bit earlier about the kind of demand and the need for these various surgeries. Can you just talk about that again, maybe specifically in relation to new knees or new hips or whatever?
Well, in the West Midlands here, we've got over 500,000 people waiting for a hospital appointment, 500,000. And of those, 20,000 have been on a waiting list for over a year. Now, you know, we talk about the NHS being broken. I don't agree with that. There are some wonderful treatments being carried out every minute of every day. You know, my daughter had a baby yesterday. She had the fantastic care from the hospital she was under. And we shouldn't underestimate or take for granted how wonderful the NHS can still be. The
problem Actually, I'm going to add to that. Last night, I had to take my wife to A&E, and you know, everything turned out fine, etc. But again, the service was amazing. You know, it took, well, there's a few things that had to be done. We were there for, I think, 3 hours, and then we, you know, we came home, but it was absolutely fantastic. So yeah, I love the NHS. It sounds like you do as well.
I'm glad to hear that, Mike, because so many people take it for granted. It tries to do so much, however, and the expectations on it are enormous. And we have an aging population with complex medical needs, and the challenges are enormous. And it is creaking at the seams because we don't have sufficient numbers of staff and diagnostic facilities. And that's why we've got this backup of waiting lists. And it wasn't COVID that caused it. It was bad enough before COVID. It's just got worse, and it will continue to get worse until we address some of the problems. But
and actually, the demand will grow, not just because of the problems. We're all getting older, so we're all got creaky hips.
Sure, that's right, and that's why I think it's right that we need to incorporate help from the private sector who've got capacity. They've got spare capacity, and if you've got beds available, it's only right that the NHS should have access to them, paying the same rates as they would pay for a patient in an NHS bed in an NHS hospital. And that's exactly what this hospital is doing. It's taking NHS patients to remove them from the NHS waiting list, which is enormous, as I say, in this area. But it's also looking after some private patients who choose to go down the private route because it's becoming more affordable, because they can know what the fixed costs are, and they can make their own choices.
And they don't want to wait for so long.
Yes, exactly. But the NHS patients don't have to wait here because there's no legacy waiting list at all now that this is opening up towards the end of November for surgery. It's already consulting with patients. But as I say, it's brand new. It's ready to go. And it's going to help a lot of people in this area.
Let's unpick a little bit of that, because there are some aspects to it that do worry me. So the objective of a private company is to make money, right? Now, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. It makes the world go round. The objective of the NHS is to treat people. Now, it's not to make money. I mean, it shouldn't lose money, et cetera. But, you know, they have different objectives. So if we're sending NHS patients to a private hospital, their objective is to make money. So it's going to cost more, is it not? It's going to cost everyone. You know, we're the taxpayers. We're paying for all this. It's going to cost us all a bit more, isn't it?
No, it's not going to cost the taxpayer anymore, because the NHS patients that are seen here are paying the same. The NHS is paying the same for them as they would in an NHS hospital. People have the choice to spend money. I mean, if they buy over-the-counter herbal remedies, if they choose to go on holiday or buy an expensive car, they have that choice. But they also have the choice either to stay with the NHS or to have their medical care privately. I think...
But does the private company not make any money on the NHS patients then?
Well, the NHS will pay for their care, of course, just as they would pay an NHS trust for their care. So,
But the NHS trust isn't making a profit. And the private company is. So it must be more expensive.
Not out of the NHS, because the NHS is no worse off using the facilities in the private provider care. But obviously it'll make a profit from the private patients because they are paying themselves and they'll be paying for their medical care, their anaesthesia, for their aftercare, their physio.
Private company is not
making... tariffs, if you like.
So the private company isn't making any profit from the NHS patients. They're doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. Is that right?
No. They're getting paid.
They're getting paid, but they're not making any profit.
No, it's the same cost as it would be for an NHS patient in an NHS hospital.
So does that mean they're just Yeah, so
That's
that's the
amazing.
bit I don't understand. So are they just much cheaper at doing it?
Yes, they have a they will have an arrangement with the local NHS stakeholders who will book patients here, knowing that the cost is exactly the same as it would be at the QE2 hospital up the road or any other
Yeah.
NHS hospital
So I
in this
suppose my
area.
question, maybe I'm just asking the wrong question. Why is the cost the same?
Because there's capacity, it's helping the NHS, and it's also helping the private hospital to have full capacity, to keep the workload smooth and ongoing. They're not here to make money out of NHS patients. They're here to help.
Okay,
There's
I that's the bit I'm kind of I struggle with a little bit, you know, because I've got a small business, I run a business,
yeah.
and I sell stuff. I don't sell stuff at a loss if I can avoid it.
The money that they would be paid from the NHS is exactly what the trust hospital would be getting to run their services. So
Oh.
they're not making a loss, but they're not making huge profits either. I think the tariff is fair and reasonable.
Okay, all right. So does that mean the people that are paying fully privately, they're subsidizing the rest of us, the NHS patients?
Well, yes, you could argue that to some extent, although this hospital group, I understand, about 30% more affordable than comparable healthcare providers.
Okay.
So they're always looking to keep costs down to make it more attractive for people to go privately, which I think inevitably will have to happen if we're going to preserve the NHS for those people who perhaps come from backgrounds where they can't afford to go private or choose not to go privately. We've got the capacity to provide private healthcare, but at an affordable rate.
I do understand that, you know, we're going to have to get creative to save the NHS, and there's lots of different ways of doing it. I'm not being difficult for the hell of it, but
No.
I do think these questions that are the sorts of questions that, you know, everybody will think, hang on a moment, that seems a bit odd. So so thank you for persevering and putting up with these questions. But I think it's important. I think people do want to know.
No, absolutely. There's. I think it's really nice that a patient who sees their GP can use the NHS Choose and Book scheme under the right their rights under the NHS Constitution to say, I would like to go to this hospital in this location because it's convenient for me, and I would like to see what the waiting list is at these different hospitals and choose the hospital where I could be seen quickest. And
Yeah.
people don't often realize they also have the right, if they're on a waiting list at hospital A and it's exceedingly long, they have the right to be removed from that waiting list and transferred to another hospital where the waiting list is shorter. And
Okay.
surely
So
that's in everybody's interest, even if it's a private provider, knowing that the NHS isn't going to be out of pocket as a result.
yeah. So this is what you refer to as choose and book.
Yes,
Okay.
and your GP should be able to give you a list of potential providers that you can have a look at and do your research and find out which one you'd like to go to.
So I'm lucky. So I'm okay. I'm a little bit younger than you, not much, but I haven't got a need for a new knee or anything at the moment. But if I did, I'd be on the phone this afternoon saying, right, I want to be in that hospital in Birmingham tomorrow.
Yeah.
So isn't everyone doing that? Won't that waiting list just fill up, or
Well, it will do.
it'll
Yes, it will do. It'll be,
right in
I
an
think
hour?
it'll be very popular. At full capacity, this hospital will probably be able to carry out about 8,000 procedures a year.
Yeah.
And that's going to not only make a big dent in the waiting list in this area, but it's going to give a lot of patients a lot of satisfaction. They're going to get their treatment quicker locally. From a hospital that is very welcoming, quite personal, not too big, so that you get lost in the system. And I think it will be popular, and that's what we want it to be. We want it to be at full capacity, helping as many patients as possible.
So, in general terms, do patients make use of this choose and book idea a lot. You know, are people traveling around the country to get a slot for an operation?
It's beginning to happen.
Right.
It's a system that's been in place for a little while. And you could argue that you'd have to be quite savvy to use it, but it is being used. It does work. And for some people, it means, you know, choosing a location which is convenient to them. It might be miles away from where they live because their relatives might live there, and that's who the people who'll be looking after them afterwards, after the surgery. So it frees up people to go where they want to be treated, and it also means you can join a shorter waiting list than you would otherwise be on.
Yeah, no, you've got to sweat your assets, haven't you? You know, you've got to use what's
Yes.
available. But
Yeah.
I suppose the final question, if people are listening to this and they are faced with, you know, months of waiting before some surgery, and that they're thinking, oh, I like the sound of what I've just heard. How can I get involved? How can I book myself into this new hospital in Birmingham
The
or
best thing
somewhere
to
else? What can they do?
sure. Well, if you're yet to be referred, you can ask your GP to give you the list which is available to them so that you can choose the location, look at the waiting list, and say, I'd like to go there. That's your right. If you're already on a waiting list, which is very long, then you can say, could I be re-referred to this other place where the waiting list is shorter? So in a way, you have to be a bit savvy. Hopefully you get help from your GP or your healthcare provider to assist you with that. But yes, it should streamline your treatment and get it quicker for you.
All right, because it won't just be the length of the list, it'll be how fast they can get through the patients as well. So, there's a couple of things working there.
Yes, of course, because some procedures will mean a longer downtime than others. Knee surgery, for example, it's a longer recovery than it is for hip surgery. Hip surgery, you're probably out the second day. You know, you'll probably be up and walking the day after your surgery. You'll be
Yeah.
doing a few steps the same evening and probably home the next day. It's incredible. But knee surgery will take longer. And of course, depending on the age of the patient, the general condition of the patient, you know, it's different for different people. But these days, rehabilitation it can often be done at home with visits to the hospital. And if people are given the instructions, that they can get home very quickly and free up that bed for the next person. It's about
Yeah.
efficiency.
Well, excellent. Really interesting. I know this topic is going to continue, use of private health and NHS health all mixed up. This discussion will go on and on, well, forever probably. But thank you very much indeed for coming in and chatting today. And it sounds like you've got to sharpen your scissors and go and cut a ribbon just now.
Yes, and I shall look forward to that. It's always a happy occasion. And by the way, I've met several staff here who've worked in the previous establishment, which was a clinical setting, for more than 20 years, and they're absolutely thrilled to be part of the refurbishment. And they feel that the healing environment has come back to the place. They talk with love about the atmosphere here now, and the air of optimism, hope, and everything else that goes into a new hospital being opened for the benefit of people in the area.
And that's going to rub off on the patients, I'm absolutely sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, good. Lovely. Hilary, thank you so much for chatting.
Pleasure, Mike. Take care of yourself.
The station that makes you feel good.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Before the next guest, I just want to tell you about a book I've written which draws on the knowledge on the and the experience of guests that I've had on the show. It's called Cut the Crap, Ask the Questions That Matter About Your Health. There are contributions and quotes from many people who really are at the top of their game, and they've all been on the show. There's Dr. Zoe Williams, Dr. Roger Henderson, dietitian Sophie Medlin, pain doctor Dr. Furlan, brain surgeon Dr. Rahul Jandail, Olympian and coach to comic relief stars Professor Greg White, ski jumper Eddie the Eagle, breast cancer surgeon turned breast cancer patient Liz O'Riordan, businesswoman Shah Wasmond, England rugby international George Cruz, professional footballer Thomas Robson-Kanu, and many, many more. The book will be available from November the 1st on Amazon. And again, the title is Cut the Crap, Ask the Questions That Matter About Your Health. Now, coming up, I chat with dietitian Dr. Carrie Ruxton. It's all about the humble egg. But my first question is, what's the difference between a dietitian and a nutritionist?
Well, Mike, a dietitian uses food like a medicine in a clinical sense. So we do a 4-year degree, the same as nutritionists do. But the big difference is we spend a year of that working in a hospital. So we work with patients, we work in clinics. And so when we finish our qualification, we can either work in hospital or the community or even for industry. And despite going down the route of dietetics, I actually work for quite a broad range of organisations and I do a lot of media. So I don't actually work in a hospital anymore.
Right. OK. But also dietitian is a reserved title, isn't it? So because I couldn't call myself a dietitian without getting into trouble, but I could call myself a nutritionist this afternoon and charge people to tell them what to eat. They'd be crazy to take my advice, but I could do that.
Yes, that's right. Dietitian is protected, and perhaps someday nutritionists will be too. I think that would help the public have more trust in going to see a nutritionist.
Okay. One final thing on this topic. You're a doctor. So are you an MD or a PhD?
I'm a PhD. I did my PhD in children's diets where I had to get scales and measure children's diets for 7 days. And it was a real labour of love, and I finished it more than 20 years ago.
Good. All right. But it's a PhD in a relevant topic, because I have come across people using the term doctor somewhat fraudulent, might be a bit unfair, but, you know, calling themselves doctors.
PhDs are the real doctors.
Oh, I know. I'm married to one. She tells me on a daily basis.
I can imagine that.
We should crack on and talk about the topic of eggs. It isn't that long ago, I think, I've got a funny memory, that we were told we shouldn't eat that many eggs because they were full of cholesterol. Is that true? Is there a sort of cap on how many eggs we should eat?
Not anymore, Mike. So about more than 20 years ago, people were worried about the cholesterol in foods like eggs and prawns, and they thought that they raised people's cholesterol levels. But then they did the studies and actually gave people eggs and checked what happened to their blood cholesterol levels. And the answer was nothing. So they then realised that eating cholesterol, because if you think about it, you know, your gut is a fantastic organ for breaking things down, a little bit like Lego blocks. So you kind of eat Lego blocks as your food, and then your gut breaks it all down into the individual bits. They then get absorbed, and then your body reassimilates them as something else. So just because you've got cholesterol in your food, it does not mean that it's going to end up as cholesterol in your blood. What does push up the cholesterol in your blood is eating saturated fats. So these are the fats that we would get in cakes, biscuits, ice creams, frying things in lard, very fatty meat pies, cream and cheese and things like that. So if we are worried about our cholesterol, you do not have to limit eggs at all. All the limits have been taken off, but you still need to be worried about those foods that are high in saturated fats.
That is really good to hear, because I love eggs and I eat a lot of them, and I do have to worry a little bit about my cholesterol levels. So that's a great answer. Thank you very much. But going back in history again, actually, possibly further, the famous Edwina Curry, her nickname became Eggwina Curry because she said that most eggs in the UK were contaminated with salmonella. So what was going on there? Was she just wrong?
No, she wasn't wrong. And actually, she did she probably wasn't the favourite person of the egg industry, but they needed a kick up the backside and they got it. So what happened was that as egg production got larger and larger, as more people wanted to buy eggs rather than have hens at home, then they realised that if you're going to have flocks of hens together, you do get natural bacteria from the environment that then infects the hens and infects the eggs. And so what happened was there was a complete revolution in food safety in the egg industry, which I'm really, it's such a success story for the UK. And what they do now is they have massive hygiene and biosecurity. They inoculate the hens against salmonella. So now we've gone from Edwina Curry giving the egg industry a telling off to British eggs. These are the ones with the red line on them being amongst the safest in the whole world. And the great thing is that if you go into any supermarket, you can see those eggs with the red line on it. Where you've got to be a little bit more careful is when you go into food service, like if you go down to your Chinese takeaway and order egg fried rice or go and get an omelette in a pub, you then need to ask them what sort of eggs they use, because other countries have still got a salmonella problem. And there's been a lot of cases over the last 10 years where people have eaten eggs in food service and they've become ill with salmonella. But British eggs are safe now. In fact, they're so safe that the Food Standards Agency wrote a report, must have been about 10 years ago now, 8 to 10 years ago, saying that British line eggs can be eaten by all age groups, even babies and elderly people and people who are ill in hospital. And not only that they can have them raw or lightly cooked. Because it used to be that if you're an old person in a care home, they would say, oh, you want an egg for breakfast? We're going to have to boil it to death until it's really dry before it's safe to eat. And that is not the case. You know, granny can have a runny yolk and dip her soldiers in, and you can give eggs to your baby from 6 months onwards. So again, a real success story. And I think it's really good when industry responds in that way. It makes their product.
In a funny sort of way, Edwina Curry in 1988 was kind of good for UK eggs.
She was, and I actually met her once. I met her because when I was training as a dietitian at Queen Margaret University in Edinburgh, she actually came up to our university and looked around the diet and nutrition department. So I did shake her hand and meet her.
Okay, and interesting, because actually, I mean I eat a lot of eggs, but I would, before eating raw eggs, I would think, should I be doing this? But you kind of answered the questions that actually, yeah, if
you've got to look for that line though. Look for the line and you'll be absolutely fine. And again, it's great to see British farmers responding in that way. I mean, I'm really proud of the food that we produce in the UK. And I travel a lot for business and I do love coming home and eating some of the fantastic produce that our farmers make.
All right, so look, you're obviously banging the drum for British eggs. I'm going to let you drum it a bit more. Give us some other health benefits of eggs. Why should we be eating them?
Well, to find out that, we need to drill down to what's in an egg. So we all know what an egg looks like, but did you know that it's got 6 grams of protein in it, which is really large on protein for such a tiny little package? It's also got more than 10 vitamins and minerals, including things like vitamin D, iodine, B vitamins. It's got something called choline in it, which is a type of fatty substance that's really important for the developing fetus. And studies have shown that many women are actually low in choline. They're not eating enough choline sources. And eggs are certainly a really healthy way to get that into the diet for pregnant women. So there's lots of things in eggs. And studies have shown that eggs are great for a number of things. I'll just mention two or three. One is actually weight management. And they think it's because of the high protein content and the way that it's packaged in a portion, basically. So if you have two eggs, that's what I would call a portion. And studies have shown that if you compare an egg breakfast with having bagels, you feel fuller for longer after eggs, and you're more likely to kind of manage what you eat for the next few hours. You know, we call it satiety, where you feel fuller. Mm-hmm. You're then not likely to reach for the biscuit tin. And that's more effective when you have eggs in the diet. And then another thing is muscle decline, because as you get older, sort of around about my age, and you get into menopause, your muscles do start to decline. And that means that you're getting weaker, and you're more likely to fall. You also replace the muscle with fat. So you're actually getting fatter as you get older, even if you're the same body weight. And it's a lot harder to build and maintain those muscles. But they found that the special types of protein building blocks in eggs, which are called amino acids, are particularly good for the human body. So when we take in those amino acids, we're actually much more likely to build and maintain muscle. So right from young age, where I've got a 24-year-old son who's a bodybuilder and a CrossFit athlete, he eats masses of eggs. And then at my age, when I'm sort of battling the menopause, I eat eggs so that I can maintain my muscles. So there's kind of, you know, two examples of fantastic.
Yeah, some very, very, very positive thoughts on eggs. Not meaning to be a bit negative, but I think it's kind of an important question, and people may well be thinking it because it's been in the news. Well, it wasn't in the news certainly a year ago, a few months ago. What about bird flu? Bird flu, does that affect eggs? And if because it, you know, it was in the country, lots of birds were put down, and farmers had to be very careful of how they farm them. They couldn't let them outside, all that sort of thing. So tell us about bird flu and the concerns about eggs from that.
Now, that's an animal disease. So what we're concerned about is actually hens becoming ill. And then what happens is that when you've got a bird flu epidemic, which tends to come from the wild population, so hens are running around outside, and so are seagulls and seabirds and garden birds are all running around as well. And these diseases can get passed on to hen flocks. And so the rules are that when there is a bird flu epidemic in your area, the farmers have got to keep the hens indoors, and DEFRA will enforce that, particularly for commercial flocks. But even as a hen keeper at home, I used to keep four hens for many years, and I would also have to keep those hens indoors. But the most important thing for people wanting to eat eggs is that this is not transmissible to humans in the UK. There have been a couple of cases in the Far East where people practically live with their chickens. You know, the chickens are in and out of the house, and kids are picking them up and holding them and not washing their hands. But for the average consumer buying eggs in a supermarket, there is no risk for bird flu. We are taking those measures to protect hen flocks, because it's not nice for them to have bird flu. They get ill, and we want to protect them from that.
Okay, so if you eat eggs, you can't suffer from bird flu if they come from a chicken that has bird flu.
Absolutely. Well, you wouldn't want hens to have bird flu in the first place. So you would shut them away, and you would wait until everything was over before you then sold the eggs. We've got really strict food safety rules in the UK. For example, whether it's for meat or whether it's for eggs, if you're actually treating your animals for any illnesses, you can't sell the produce. So that kind of adds an extra layer of protection to consumers.
Very good. All right. Another question, actually. And again, this is almost sounding a bit negative, is not meant to be. But nowadays, you hear of a lot of people suffering from allergies. And one of the allergies that I've heard of is an allergy to eggs. Do people have to really be careful about that? You know, can that cause real problems?
Yeah, there's about 2-3% of people that have allergies, and it tends to be the child population. So allergies to things like milk and eggs, and sometimes wheat can occur in young children, because when they're growing and the hormones are flying all over the place and their bodies are changing, they can be more susceptible to allergies. But most children will outgrow an egg allergy and even a dairy allergy as well. So if your child has that kind of allergy, then obviously you need to avoid those foods and just keep checking in on them with your doctor as they get older, because, as I said, in most cases they will outgrow those allergies when they reach sort of, you know, late primary age. But there's another interesting research element to this. They think that one of the reasons why there is a high amount of food allergies and even things like asthma and dust allergies is because children's immune systems are not being challenged enough when they're very young. So you've got this window of opportunity during weaning where you really want to get as much variety into children's diets as possible. So once a child gets to 6 months of age, it's then open season for trying lots of different foods. Obviously, you've got to be careful with things like salt and sugar, because that's not necessary for their growth and development, and you don't want them to get a taste for it. But certainly, it's okay to give eggs. And there was a study that showed that if you introduce these potentially allergenic foods to young children's diets when they're about 6 to 9 months, you can reduce their chance of having an allergy. So if you wait too long, you actually increase the risk of allergy. Whereas if you get in quick at 6 months and encourage your baby to eat a variety of foods, you reduce their risk of allergies.
That sounds like excellent advice. Okay, let me finish with a couple of questions. First of all, what did you have for breakfast today?
Oh, I have every morning I have Greek yogurt with muesli and cherries and pumpkin seeds and flax seeds. That's my go-to breakfast.
That sounds very nice. I was kind of hoping you were going to say eggs.
Yeah, well, I do have eggs, but I have them for lunch. So I'm not very good at sitting down and eating a proper lunch. So what my husband does is he boils eggs in advance and puts them in the fridge. And then I go and help myself to a couple of boiled eggs and some veggies, or maybe make a smoothie up in the Nutribullet. And that's my quick lunch, so that I actually get something nutritious. I actually said in an earlier interview today that I boiled the eggs, and my husband shouted upstairs, "No, you don't. I do it." So I promise that I'm going to give him due credit for boiling the eggs.
Yeah, he needs the credit. But whoever does boil the eggs doesn't matter, because you practice what you preach.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I'm very sad that I don't have chickens anymore, because I used to love my chickens to bits. And I just used to eat eggs every single day for lunch. And I used to love going out in the morning and collecting the eggs and then eating them for lunch. And that's just got me into the habit now of just enjoying eggs on a regular basis. And if you look at the studies as well, I mentioned earlier that people are only eating fewer than 4 eggs a week. The studies show that you can get the most benefit from eggs eating 7 to 14 a week. So it's like 1 to 2 a day if you want. I'm not saying that I'm prescribing that, but you can do that if you want to. And if you think I'm going to be bored with boiled eggs, there's a really good website, egginfo.co.uk, that's got amazing recipes on it with mouth-watering pictures that I'm sure will give your listeners some inspiration.
Yeah, well, that was actually going to be my next question. So you're very good at answering questions before I even ask them. So perfect. I think that's an excellent place to finish. So, Harry, thank you very much indeed for taking a few minutes to chat about eggs.
Thanks, I've really enjoyed it, Mike.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show, and they were Dr. Hilary Jones talking about the capacity of the NHS and Dr. Carrie Ruxton talking about eggs. Thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
UK Health Radio. the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.